You're listening to Neurodiversity at Work.
Life can be so shady. The way some people try to bring you down. Why's it got to be so crazy? Always trying to give you the run over.
Today's episode is sponsored by Updemize. Updemize is a unique training platform that helps companies hire and retain neurodiverse talent. They are already working with an amazing client list globally. I actually first came across Updemize when I met CEO and founder Ed Thompson at an event. Ed's talk inspired me to actually do this podcast and all the other interesting and fascinating things I'm getting involved in around neurodiversity. If you want to find out more about Optimize and their work, head to optimize.com. That's Optimize with a Z. I also interviewed Ed in episode 2, so why don't you go and check it out there? Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Julie Sowash. Julie is Executive Director of Disability Solutions, but also Crazy and the King podcast host with Torin Ellis. She shares some of her personal experiences with us, but also some of the wonderful work that she's been doing at Disability Solutions. I'm sure you're going to find this of real interest. Hi, Julie. Welcome to the podcast. Really pleased to have you on. Would you like to introduce yourself to our audience, let them know who you are, what you do?
Sure, absolutely. Thank you, Theo, for having me. I'm so excited to be here. My name is Julie Sowash. I am the Executive Director of Disability Solutions, and I'm also the co-host of a podcast called Crazy and the King with my good friend Torin Ellis. I am an American woman, obviously, and I have multiple diagnoses. One of them is neurodiverse, and the others are around mental illness. And so I'm thrilled to be here and have this conversation with you today.
Brilliant. So yes, if you've not listened to Crazy and the King, please do. It's fantastic, a great podcast. And that's where I first heard your voice and became aware of the great work that you do. So what does neurodiversity mean to you? You mentioned that you, you associate with being neurodiverse, but what exactly does the term and that mean to you personally?
Yeah, so like I said, I have mental illness and I have a neurodiversity diagnosis. So I primarily, in terms of neurodiversity, I have ADD that didn't get diagnosed properly until I was in my late 20s. And so I had been treating my mental illnesses for many years. And once I became aware of what neurodiversity was, and I had a great relationship and a great co-working relationship with some leaders in the disability community that really helped me recognize that I wasn't getting all of the supports that I needed. And I was able to get that diagnosis and start to manage my ADD through a variety of ways that I was really able to get my mental health disabilities under control, which are kind of the primary ones that cause problems for me from time to time. And I really found some stability in my life. And so I really became passionate about neurodiversity once I learned, A, how broad it was, but B, how it also impacts the other things in my life that were more problematic or more challenging for me. And wanted to start to open that conversation to other people, especially women who are often suffering from undiagnosed mental illness and aren't being treated correctly, to recognize that there's kind of this larger world that they may be a part of.
So how did you feel prior to the diagnosis? What was your experience growing up? How do you think it impacted you not being aware of being neurodiverse?
You know, I grew up in a really Midwestern, very religious family, and I've struggled with depression, anxiety, and panic attacks since I was a teenager. And so much of that was related to the fact that I couldn't get my brain to shut down. I couldn't stop sort of the circling and the chaos that was happening all of the time in my brain. And while my mom was great about mental health counseling and all of those things, there was also a lot of pressure to be more faithful, to trust in God more. And that added a unique layer of guilt to the fact that I couldn't get my brain to shut down, and a feeling of failure a lot of times because I couldn't control the things that were happening in my mind. And so, you know, it impacted me in terms of my self-confidence and where I felt my value was and my ability to be successful, because I couldn't manage this piece. And so it did impact me a lot more than I recognized at the time, because I just didn't have the life experience or the information. And obviously, you know, I grew up in the late 80s, early 90s as a teenager, and that the information that we have around neurodiversity was just not available at that time. And there was still and still is so much stigma around mental health and treating and asking for help with mental health issues that I just didn't know the right things to talk about, and didn't know the right things to ask. And my parents, who were doing the best they could, also didn't know the right things to ask.
Do you think, so from research and information that I've gathered, I've been able to uncover that women generally find, one, that it's more difficult to identify with being neurodiverse and to get the diagnosis and to understand early on enough in their lives that they might be neurodiverse, but also then being able to then communicate that in the workplace. I've heard of women actually feeling like the way that they're treated after they come out and say, you know, that they may be on the spectrum or they may be neurodiverse, that people treat them very differently. And of course, that diagnosis then can have almost the opposite effect and actually have a real negative impact on mental health and well-being. Have you found this? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. And this actually relates really nicely to a topic that Torn and I just talked about last week on our podcast around the way that women treat each other in not just the workplace, but in life. And so when women identify what are perceived as weaknesses in other women, those differences tend to be exploited to keep a level power playing field. And mental health and neurodiversity, diverse or disabilities that are hidden, are especially big vulnerabilities for women. And that creates a situation where it becomes cyclical. We can't talk about who we are. We can't bring our whole selves to work. And that impacts our performance, impacts our relationship with our coworkers. But then when we talk about it, that perceived weakness is leveraged from time to time. And it is also almost as regularly as it is leveraged, it is seen as not real. And so I think especially in American culture, women are taught to be invulnerable in the workplace. And if we show our vulnerabilities, that creates a sense of incompetence or ineptitude. You know, we didn't show up for every single soccer game and every single practice and every single meeting, and we weren't prepared with the baked cookies and all of these things that are pressures on women to be perfect, never allow us to have the conversations that we need to be healthy. And women especially don't do a great job of supporting each other when we are talking about who we are. And I can tell you this, like I've only been self-identifying as a person with a disability out loud for about 5 years. And every time I walk into a client's office or a room where we're teaching other employers and employees about disabilities, when I talk about mental health diagnosis, neurodiversity diagnosis, I get two responses. One is, okay, you know, sure, you're disabled. Here you are functioning as an executive. You know, you're running a company. Or the, oh, she's broke or she's scary. I've had people sort of have that fear factor put into place that now I'm sort of this unpredictable unit that they can't account for, whether that would be just someone who doesn't show up, who can't be consistently relied upon, or someone who, you know, might lose it someday and be a danger to herself or others. And that's really frustrating. And as women, and I don't want to just keep coming back to that, but as women who are going to have the primary diagnosis or the majority of diagnoses around mental health or neurodiversity, we need to do better at supporting each other in the workplace and not weaponize that against each other. Because the likelihood is that at some point a woman is going to have a hidden disability, more likely than a man, and we need to be supporting each other better now.
Yeah, absolutely agree. And I think it is important to shine the light on women, because actually there is not enough conversations happening, and there's not enough people willing to stand up and have that conversation. I mean, we do have some great people in the UK who are doing some fantastic work around neurodiversity, mental health and well-being, but it's still the few rather than the many. And I think there's probably a lot of women out there who need to hear, you know, the supportive message, and maybe how they should deal with it in their situation. Because I think you're right. I think some organisations, either the way they're led, the managers, whatever it may be, are not in a place where they're going to be supportive for whatever reason. And I mean, what would your advice be to, I guess, anybody who's neurodiverse, but when they're making a decision around maybe diagnosis, how it's going to impact their lives and their work? I mean, what types of things did you consider before being able to express the fact that you're neurodiverse and your mental health?
I will go ahead and acknowledge that I come from a place of big privilege on this, because this is what I do every day, right? I help companies build programs for people with disabilities. And so there is that. And I'm also a Caucasian or a white woman, so there is privilege that's built into that. And so I think when we're thinking about how to tell our story, how to bring our whole selves to work, to have those conversations, what I started doing even before I started talking about it at work, I started testing out those conversations with my friends, with my family, and not like, I really think that we treat disability and mental illness and hidden disabilities so often like we have to have this big scary conversation, and at work we only talk about it, about disability, when we're talking about legal matters. And what I try to do is start to just have conversations. Hey, you know, my mind is racing today. Maybe I forgot to take my medicine. I'm having some anxiety. And try to normalize those conversations and start to build your story that way. It doesn't need to be this big coming out moment if you don't want it to be. And sometimes that puts pressure on your coworkers or your family that they're not ready for. And I think especially as a woman who leads an organization and who has a voice in corporate America, it's my responsibility to talk about the good days and the bad days and to tell that story, but to do it in a way that, and I don't love the word normalized, so kind of take that for what it's worth, but that makes who I am a part of an everyday conversation, because then people are just used to me talking about who I am and the things that are happening, and they're not waiting for that big blow up, or they're not waiting for this really intense conversation. It's just like, yeah, you know, Julie's brain is always on fire. Yeah, Julie struggles with some anxiety. If you see her disappear for a while, she may be having a panic attack. But she'll, you know, once her meds kick in, or once, you know, she's able to control and get back to level, then she'll be back. And so I have those responsibilities to have that conversation. And I think as more women in leadership are willing to have those conversations, then the more open other women will be able to be about it. Honestly, it's not unusual at all in what we do and the people that we work with in terms of corporate leaders to have this kind of aha moment about how scared people are that work for them are to talk about who they are. And even to the extent that I've had several parents of people with neurodiverse children who have said, I've never even told my coworkers that my child is on the spectrum because I was scared about what they would think of me. I mean, how crazy is that? That you can't even say to your coworker, yeah, my kid is on the spectrum, and feel comfortable with that. And then the other thing that they get to see is that release of that heaviness and that fear when they're just able to talk freely about who they are as a person and not just who they are as an employee.
Wow. So you've hit on something there that I've been thinking about recently that may seem obvious, but organizations have not just got an opportunity to do the right thing and to support those who are neurodiverse within the organization, but imagine how powerful a message it is to say, we understand some of you may be neurodiverse, some of you may face different challenges. We'll all face some level of challenge within the workspace, right? It's not perfect for us all. But to say to them, you may not be neurodiverse, my wife's not neurodiverse, but my wife is the mother of a child who's neurodiverse. So when she goes into the workplace, this isn't now about her and the way that the workplace impacts her, but it's actually around what's going on at home. She has to deal with me, first of all, which, trust me, is a challenge in itself, right? I'm surprised she manages to live with me. But this is the reality. What could employers achieve, like the dizzy heights that they could achieve by showing their workforce? Neurodiversity is just not a thing around their employees. It impacts their employees at home, and they could show themselves to be so caring and so respectful of their employees if they could just think broader than their four walls of the workplace.
Right. As a leader who, you know, started off as a doer, what I recognize that's missing in so much of corporate culture is teaching people how to lead. And I got promoted the first time because I was good at doing my job. I wasn't good at leading a team. And some of the very basic elements of leadership that we should all be putting into place, that we should all be teaching the managers and the leaders beneath us, is really going to be impactful for people with disabilities, especially hidden disabilities or always not obvious disabilities, because they teach empathy. They teach to look at the entire person. They teach different ways of learning styles and design styles that are going to be so impactful to people that you may never know as a leader have a disability, but can be more productive, more fulfilled, and have more purpose in their career because you are a better leader. And that's going to be universally applicable, but especially important to people who don't yet have the comfort to bring their whole selves to work, whether that's as a parent of a person with a disability who is having an entirely different parenting experience than the majority of us, or it's as a person who needs to be able to talk about who they are and how they need to learn, how they need to be able to be productive in their job that may be outside of the everyday channels of how you do it, but doesn't make it any less impactful. And, you know, I think sometimes it's easy for companies in the United States, what we see may actually be a little bit opposite from you in the UK, is that primarily when we talk about disability, like employee resource groups and those kind of things, it is around parents who feel passionate about having support and having those conversations as caregivers and as parents. And those are some of the more leading voices in some of the companies that we work with. And where we've also found kind of the opposite challenge is parents don't look at their children as adults, right? I mean, I'm a parent. I'm a hover parent, helicopter mom, if that's a term that you all use and recognize. And so if I had a child who had a disability, I would be that much more protective and hovering, because I would want them to be safe and cared for and to have a great experience all of the time. And sometimes as employers, that experience with our child with a disability can translate into how we think about all people with disabilities and what we think their level of effectiveness can be in our workplace. And so there's a duality to the caregiver and the person. And companies who really want to get ahead of how to really be an employer of choice, to be diversity friendly and diversity in or disability engaged, need to recognize that the needs of parents as caregivers caregivers of a person with a disability and employees with a disability and the talent conversation are very, very different, but they should both be tackled in a good, smart diversity plan.
Absolutely. And it resonates with me because I speak within our organization and, you know, you do get people who, once you start to bring the conversation to the table, the hands go up, you know, and it is my son, my daughter, me, my brother, my cousin, my friend. And there's a release and a relief around being able to express that and share that and have that conversation. I mean, how would you recommend to organizations or to leaders within organizations to take the first step? I mean, contact you, I would imagine, but what are the things they could consider?
So when you're building a diversity and inclusion strategy, one, it should include people with disabilities and caregivers of people with disabilities, either children or parents. And we can't continue to have diversity and inclusion programs at the corporate level that omit people with disabilities. We're the largest diversity group in the world, the largest diversity group in the United States. And most companies are still focused on race and gender, which still have a lot of work to do. But there's disability in women. There's disability in people of color. There is disability in LGBT groups, veterans groups, right? So we're a part of every single group. And by omitting us, you're missing out. So let's just start there, right? Have us as a part of the conversation. And the second piece is when you're building a business strategy or a business program, that's what it is. And so if you're talking about hiring people with disabilities or trying to increase comfort with self-disclosure and self-identification within your organization, that's a cultural thing, right? It's not a legal conversation. It's a cultural impact that takes place over time. And all of those things are business-focused activities, and they need to be treated. They need to have strategy. They need to have messaging and marketing and conversations. And it's not like the answer is not, I'm going down to the street to my local community-based organization that helps people with disabilities, and I'm going to tell them, hey, I want to hire people. That's part of the tactical implementation, but this should be treated as a strategy that has a solid business return, that has a mutually beneficial outcome, right? I find great talent, and a person who needs to get to work finds a home. And so when we start to think about these things in terms of getting started, treat it like you do any other project. Treat it like you do any other talent acquisition strategy. And then recognize that once you have that in place, that it also has a very emotional impact, right? Why do I get out of bed in the morning? Why do I jump on podcasts? Why do I build PowerPoints? Why do I do all these things? It's because I know that I'm changing people's lives and that I'm changing the minds of corporate leaders about what my community can do in their workplace. And don't lose that good feeling when you're building a business-driven program. Take advantage of both of those emotional morale impacts that you'll have in your workplace, and tell a great story with data. That is absolutely the number one piece, is tell a great story, do it with data, and do it with the great people that you're hiring. And when you think about it holistically, it becomes something that can be managed and has enterprise level value. And what also call me.
Yes. What do you think, Julie, then, is the main reason when organizations don't take that step? What is the thing that stops them, do you find? Is there a single thing, or is there a number of kind of the top reasons why they fear making that step?
So I think there are two reasons that are the primary. The first one is something I've mentioned a couple times, but probably need some more context. At least in the United States, everything around disability and employment is really focused on, for a company, is risk mitigation. So how do we make sure that we're being inclusive enough to not get sued or not get fined? How do we help, you know, build up these numbers of people who will say they're a person with a disability so we can meet the certain affirmative action numbers that we need? But outside of that, we don't really want to talk about it or see you or make any accommodation that we're not required to. And so when we're thinking of an entire sector of our world as nothing but risk, that gets ingrained as a corporate value. And people don't take action when everything surrounding a community is fear-based. And the other one is a little bit harder to explain, but I think will resonate when people kind of hear it, is that there's still very much an otherness about people with disabilities. And so that feeling that we're not fully human, that we're not fully capable. And so when someone thinks about hiring a person with a disability into a role that they started in or that they're in now, and that person with a disability is broken, or they're only kind of experiencing half of life, what does that say about the person who isn't disabled, right? What does that say about me if I can do this job and the person sitting next to me is broken and they can do my job? And so that there's that push against inclusion because it's somehow reflective on the abled person that they could or should be doing more than they're doing because a disabled person is doing just as well in that role. And that's really, I think, unconsciously a huge part of the bias that we still see in the everyday employee. And I guarantee you that they don't recognize that, but it is their kind of undertones of what should I have accomplished if a person who's broken can do this job. And that's not the case. But those, I think, are the two primary barriers that we're still looking at when we really think about true disability and inclusion in a workplace.
Wow. And the amount of pressure, again, that then puts on the individual. If they do manage to get into the workplace,
right,
they, you know, already they've got all these things, all, you know, potential biases or negative feelings that may surround them.
Exactly.
So, Julie, what's next for you? What do you have coming up? What should we look out for? What are you currently up to?
Oh my goodness. So I'm actually going to be in London next month in March at the Unleash and at TA Tech London. So if anyone's around, that would be great. Would love to meet in person.
Amazing. I'll see you there.
Oh, good. Wonderful. A lot of speaking events in the United States and several visits over to the UK this year. Also be at RecFest in July, I believe. And yay. So that'll be really fun. That is an awesome event. We are at Disability Solutions. We are rolling out some big new brands this month and next month to really push our outcomes and push those companies that we're working with to hire people with disabilities. We've helped the companies we work with hire just about 3,000 people over the last 5 years with disabilities, and we're looking to add 2,020 hires within those companies in 2020. So we've got a fun goal ahead of us this year as a team, and I'm gonna just keep kicking it with my pod buddy Torin on Crazy and the King, and switching up our format and doing some fun stuff in year two.
Incredible. Yeah, you and Tori make a great team. I really appreciate you coming on. And yeah, anybody who's not aware of the work that you're doing, they should get in contact. They should find you on LinkedIn and connect for sure.
Absolutely. That would be wonderful.
Well, I can't wait to meet you at the upcoming events, Unleash and RecFest and who knows what else. And thanks so much for coming on, Julie. I mean, it's been a really interesting and fascinating podcast.
Thanks for having me.
This episode was brought to you by Uptimize, the neurodiversity training platform for employers. If you think your business could benefit by doing more to attract and retain people who think differently, visit Uptimize's website at uptimize.com.